Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the January 5th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is Peter Navarro, Trump's Ultimate Yes Man, by Ian Parker. A reporter at large, Peter Navarro, Trump's Ultimate Yes Man. The tariff cheerleader established the template of sycophancy for Trump Administration Officials by Ian Parker, December 22, 2025. In March 2016, Peter Navarro introduced himself to students in managing geopolitical risk in an age of rising China, a new undergraduate course at the University of California, Irvine. Donald Trump was then a month away from becoming the presumptive Republican nominee for president. Navarro, who had tenure at the business school, was an academic oddity. He worked at a research university, but he'd done little serious research since finishing his doctorate in economics at Harvard 30 years earlier, and he didn't seem to enjoy contact with students. A former friend of his, an economist, recently said, "I don't think he liked teaching that much. He liked talking." Navarro had secured a life of privilege and frustration. He lived in a big house in Laguna Beach with an ocean view and a pool surrounded by statuary. But he plainly yearned to be somewhere or someone else. Professors often develop side hustles, but Navarro had long sought to trade his academic status for a more dazzling form of power. Mayor of San Diego, stock guru, Democratic congressman, television host. He'd largely failed in these ambitions thanks in part to traits he'd recognized in himself. He was arrogant, abrasive, and disdainful. "The problem was my personality," Navarro wrote in an account of his struggles as a political candidate. Although he once compared his charisma to Barack Obama's, he knew that many who met him regarded him as an asshole. He was always getting into spats. Shortly before Navarro's new course began, he sent an email to John Graham, another UC Irvine professor, asking, "Are you frigging deaf, dumb, and blind?" Navarro had first pitched his class in a mass email to 30,000 students. That spring, only 17 had enrolled. The room could have held 100. He was not a prominent professor, one of the students who'd chosen to take the course recently recalled. She remembers him as skinny and a little bit on the shorter side. Navarro, who is about 5'7", was an avid cyclist, body surfer, and cold bath plunger. Then as now, he resembled an agitated basketball coach, rolled up sleeves, graying hair combed straight back from a tanned and taut face, long drawn to language aimed at making mundane tasks sound muscular or militaristic. He instructed students to bring laptop capability. Navarro had just published Crouching Tiger, his third book, to describe China as an ugly threat to America and the world. The previous two, from 2006 and 2011, had portrayed China as an amoral economic force. The new one emphasized the country's rising military ambitions. It was bluntly polemic. Chinese missiles were designed to literally ram American satellites out of the sky. A submarine base was right out of a James Bond novel, and it contained no evidence that Navarro could speak Chinese or had even visited China. Footnotes frequently cited op-eds and Wikipedia. The book was largely ignored. A Crouching Tiger account on Twitter attracted only a few dozen followers. When Navarro was challenged about his expertise in a testy Ask Me Anything thread on Reddit, he replied, "Many of my experts get much of their source material directly from the Chinese." When comments dried up, Navarro asked, "Anybody out there?" Yet, as Navarro's students discovered, the class was the book. Each week, students discussed either Crouching Tiger or episodes of an accompanying documentary series that Navarro clearly hadn't quite finished assembling. "We would watch these weird videos," the students said. In addition to talking head interviews, there would be, like, insert animation here. Navarro appeared in front of an unaltered green screen. The student wondered if she was enrolled in a book marketing focus group. Not long after, the videos began to appear on YouTube. Navarro's teaching assistant, Ben Leffel, who had lived and worked in China, didn't share Navarro's geopolitical views. Leffel, who now teaches at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, told me that he always saw Navarro as a charlatan drawn to performative warmongering. Leffel tried to be a moderating influence, particularly on the many occasions when Navarro did not come to class, but the course remained yoked to Crouching Tiger. The student said the class's message was simple. We have to be afraid of China. The final exam was held in early June, around the time that Navarro had what he has called a surreal experience. One morning, he has written, he walked down the hill from his home in Victoria, his home to Victoria Beach, hallowed ground from where I would launch my paddleboard and cruise out among the seals and dolphins. He was expecting a call. Stephen Miller, who was then a 30-year-old speechwriter for Trump and who now oversees the federal government's efforts to terrorize people perceived to be undocumented immigrants, wanted to talk. Navarro wrote, as I sat down in the sand hoping that my cell phone reception would hold, the key thing that kept popping into my mind was how close I was to power, yet in tiny Laguna Beach, so far away. Navarro likes to say that he was one of only three senior advisors to serve Trump, from his first campaign to the end of his first term. The others he identifies are Miller and Dan Scavino, who is now deputy chief of staff. In the taxonomy of political sidekicks, Navarro, who advises on trade, isn't a carrier of darkly destructive principles like Miller, nor is he a natural political fixer, and he can't be described as a persuasive orator. His frequent TV appearances, where he tends to be uninterruptible while gesturing with his index and pinky fingers extended, like Polly Walnuts on The Sopranos, can be off-putting, even to allies. His friend Stephen Bannon, the former White House advisor turned broadcaster, once cut off Navarro's microphone to break his flow. Navarro's role is that of Mad Professor Hype Man, the president's economics mascot. As Navarro, referring to Trump, has put it, my function really, as an economist, is to try to provide the underlying analytics that confirm his intuition. And his intuition is always right. Navarro's position gives him moments of extraordinary influence on the world economy, even as it has left him ample time to pursue personal projects, including a memoir published this fall. Of Navarro's 50 or so posts on X in October, one was about the government shutdown, one was a photograph of the Washington Monument, one referred to the Dodgers, and the rest promoted his new book. Larry Remmer, who worked as a political consultant for Navarro in the 90s, told me that his former client's transcendent personality trait was the certainty that he was underappreciated. That feeling is one of the forces holding Trump's coalition together. When Trump's first term began, Navarro had no reason to rethink his posture of resentment. He was given a second-rung title as the director of a new entity called the National Trade Council with a Buy American focus. He was parked in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, which he called an outhouse. He worked on an unrequested memos, which he has called guided missives, that often cited his previous ratings. But he survived, becoming the most conspicuous backer of the president's long-held and false beliefs that the United States is being ripped off when it trades internationally. Navarro supported Trump's theories in person when he was invited to join him. He has claimed that it's a running joke between me and the president as to who figured out the problems with free trade first. More frequently, he addressed Trump via Twitter, the Sunday news shows, and CNBC. Before 2016, Navarro was largely unconnected to modern Fox News-shaped Republican politics. He certainly wasn't a true believer. His most notable political attachment of recent years has been to John Edwards, the former Democratic senator and presidential candidate. After Edwards dropped out in 2008, we've lost a good one. Nor was Navarro a lonely single-issue policy enthusiast looking for a political home. His hawkishness on China had been populist and intemperate, but it took the form of showy frustration about that country's unpunished transgressions not a rigorous proposal for American change. Navarro was open to all kinds of policy ideas. His own could sound silly or circular, make every country abide by free trade norms, balance the federal budget, elect a president like Winston Churchill. Navarro hadn't even held a consistent view about the economic risks of imposing tariffs on another country's goods in response to unfair trade practices. In his final years as a professor, a student could open The Power of Macroeconomics, a popular digital course that Navarro had recently updated, and read his warning that trade wars are born through such retaliatory measures. The Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of 1930, Navarro noted, had helped push the entire global economy into the Great Depression. The same student could read Death by China, 2011, in which Navarro complained that, ahead of any retaliatory tariff, the Wall Street Journal will really try to scare us by referencing the role of the Smoot-Hawley tariffs in triggering the Great Depression, adding, "It's all so much cow manure." Even Crouching Tiger, which appeared in 2015, stopped short of a full-throated support for tariffs against China, acknowledging that they would probably be inflationary and affect poorer Americans disproportionately. Navarro also wrote that any effective response to China required global cooperation and coordination. Then Navarro started working for a man who thinks that trade wars are good and easy to win, and that tariffs are the greatest things ever invented. He wholeheartedly backed Trump's unilateral 2018 tariffs on China, which started a trade war. In time, Navarro learned to say Democrat Party instead of Democratic, and to call Anthony Fauci an absolutely evil man allied with Chinese commies. And from a rally stage in North Carolina, Navarro packed disdain and boastfulness into the same two syllables, "When I was at Harvard getting my doctorate." Long-term service to Trump requires both egomania and its opposite, self-annihilation. The man whom Navarro likes to call the boss seems to value insincere or bought obeisance, the flapping and fussing of a maitre d', more than heartfelt fandom, which lacks the piquancy of humiliation. This work environment has clearly suited Navarro, whose sense of his own worth, though strong, seems to be divorced from allegiance to his own ideas, and who had long craved audiences of more than 17 people. He was ready to do whatever. His aggressive sycophancy in Trump's first term foretold how everyone around the president would behave in the second. Navarro is the template for the cabinet secretaries who now wait in line to flatter Trump in long televised White House meetings. The new ubiquity of this stance seems likely to diminish the standing of the man who first perfected it. But in a recent email exchange, Navarro sounded sanguine about sharing the stage. "This time," he told me, "everyone is pulling the oars in the same direction, and the boss has gotten more done in 10 months than presidents typically do in 2 terms. The intensity of Navarro's obeisance and his combativeness has sometimes made him a figure of fun. Conservatives discovered that it was permitted and surely cathartic to disparage Navarro publicly, in language they wouldn't dream of using to describe the president himself. Bannon has called criticism of Navarro veiled attacks on President Trump. Lou Dobbs, interviewing Navarro on the Fox Business Network, once accused him of peddling pablum. Jared Kushner, who helped bring Navarro into the White House in 2016, has described him as eccentric and untrustworthy. Senator Rand Paul called him a walking economic fallacy. Elon Musk was still in Trump's inner circle when several months ago he referred to Navarro as dumber than a sack of bricks for taking shots at Tesla amid his defense of widespread tariffs. Even Trump, whose character assessments tend to be uncomplicated, has reached for irony to evaluate Navarro. "He's a little different, Trump said to laughter at a signing event at the White House in 2020. "We have all types." After Trump lost the 2020 election, Navarro put on what he called his big boy Harvard researcher pants to help reassure the president that he'd actually won. That December, Navarro published the first of three pseudo-scholarly reports filled with sophistry about voter fraud, drop boxes, mail-in ballots, to argue that Joe Biden's decisive victory was likely illegitimate. A Washington Post analysis called the report possibly the most embarrassing document ever created by a White House staffer. Trump included a link to Navarro's report in a tweet that ended big protest in D.C. on January 6. Be there, we'll be wild. Navarro later proudly claimed that his election-denying writings had underpinned a plan, led by Bannon and nicknamed the Green Base Sweep, to have Congress block certification of the Electoral College vote and so allow Republican-dominated state legislators to cook up new slates of electors. The Green Base Sweep became, in Navarro's words, the last best chance to snatch a stolen election from the Democrats' jaws of deceit. In 2022, Navarro disregarded a subpoena from the Congressional Committee investigating the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. Then, after ignoring a criminal subpoena to appear before a grand jury, Navarro was indicted on charges of contempt of Congress. He was convicted in 2023. The following March, Navarro, at the age of 74, began a four-month sentence in a senior dorm at a federal prison camp in Miami. This past January, 6 months after his release, Navarro returned to government as a senior trade advisor. He wasn't vice president. Bannon had promoted that idea on his podcast. Nor was he atop a federal agency with direct authority to enact policy. And he was back in the Eisenhower executive office, not the White House, and had a staff of just four, as he put it to me, a purposely lean team built for speed and efficiency. But he was still arguably the world's most influential economist. He was an architect of the President's Liberation Day in April, which tore up existing agreements and set very high and widely ridiculed tariff rates on imports from allies and antagonists alike. Navarro hasn't disclosed his exact role in those tariff calculations. What happens in the White House Situation Room stays in the White House Situation Room, he told me. The tariff announcements, one part of his this administration's remodeling of America into a rogue superpower, brought immediate confusion to the world economy and drastically raised the likelihood of domestic inflation and recession. Tariffs are tax cuts, Navarro told Fox this spring. They are not. Tariffs are jobs. Tariffs are national security. Tariffs are great for America. Tariffs will make America great again. I recently called Alan Leibowitz, who was an English professor at Tufts for nearly 40 years, until his retirement in 2006. In the early 70s, Leibowitz accepted Navarro into his undergraduate fiction writing class. They became friends and remained in fond contact into this century. In the acknowledgments in one of Navarro's many books, he wrote that he was eternally indebted to his old teacher. I have to say that I am puzzled and saddened by where Peter is now, Leibowitz told me. This is not the Peter I knew. Let me tell you about the Peter I knew. He described two novels Navarro wrote under his supervision as an undergraduate. One of them was called Dope Opera, Leibowitz recalled. The books were on the zany side, very verbally playful and adroit. According to Leibowitz, Peter epitomized what was kind of lovable about the kids of that time. He wore his hair to his shoulders. I remember him in snow walking barefoot. Later, according to a former friend, Navarro liked to joke that there was one difference between me and Bill Clinton. I inhaled. If Navarro appeared to be fully of his era, he kept a distance from the most pressing campus issue, the Vietnam War. Navarro later recalled, I didn't have the anger some people did, but I did have the skepticism. Leibowitz remembered once taking his younger son Michael to Navarro's apartment. After dinner, Peter got his guitar out and sang folk songs, he said. His son was just enchanted. The next morning, Navarro came by with a guitar for the child, saying that he had an extra one. I don't think it was an extra, Leibowitz said. You can see why I find it so strange to see where he is now. Leibowitz knew that Navarro's father had disappeared early. This, Leibowitz felt, had surely wounded him. Albert Navarro had been a saxophonist and a clarinetist who worked as a music teacher and as a band leader at resort hotels. Peter, born in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 1949, was 8 when Al Navarro and his High Society Orchestra released an album of standards, including My Heart Belongs to Daddy. Around this time, Navarro's parents divorced. His father remarried, moved to Grosse Pointe, Michigan, and had another family. Peter's mother, Evelyn, settled in Palm Beach, Florida, with Peter and his older brother, a future commercial pilot, in what Peter has described as a garage apartment near the Kennedy compound. This puts it a few miles north of Mar-a-Lago. His mother was a secretary, then a department manager at a Saks Fifth Avenue. A family friend, a former Marine with a Purple Heart, became a key paternal influence. The family later moved north. Peter was accepted at Tufts while attending high school in Bethesda, Maryland, where he'd perfected specialist skills as a football place kicker. A kicker must accept that, thanks to his size difference in solitary training, he may not be embraced as a full member of the team. In 2022, when Navarro griped that he'd been arrested by FBI agents at a Washington, D.C. airport, instead of being allowed to present himself at the Bureau's headquarters on Pennsylvania Avenue, in a criminal case about his refusal to keep exactly that kind of appointment, he noted that he lived so close to the FBI office that he could have hit it with a football kicked from the deck of his apartment. Leibowitz's understanding was that Navarro had grown up with little money. He had secured a federally subsidized loan offered to students from lower-income families. In the 90s, when Navarro became a serial political candidate, he didn't emphasize having risen from modest beginnings, as many such aspirants do. Nor did he invoke Palm Beach to discuss the particular experience of having been not rich in a very rich community, which decades later, on a different scale, became his experience in Trump administrations run by billionaires and half-billionaires, including Trump, Musk, and the Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and Stephen Mnuchin, and the Commerce Secretaries Howard Lutnick and Wilbur Ross. Navarro's reticence about his background may have reflected a protectiveness towards his mother, who later remarried and became wealthy enough to give him hundreds of thousands of dollars, which helped fund his political career. Mike Aguirre, a former San Diego city attorney and a one-time friend of Navarro's, recently described that maternal bond as the only sincere relationship I know about in Navarro's life. Soon after Navarro graduated from Tufts in 1972 with an English degree, he flew to northeastern Thailand as a Peace Corps teacher. He has described motorcycling through the countryside with the humid air blowing through my hair while screaming out the lyrics to We're an American Band. Jim Jupi, a Peace Corps contemporary in Thailand, lived about 50 miles from Navarro, who sometimes visited on weekends. Jupi said recently with slight disapproval, "If you wanted to get laid, you came to my province." Navarro denied this, saying that he didn't remember Jupi. He noted that during the height of the sexual revolution in America, he didn't need a passport to find sex. In Jupi's memory, Navarro was full of himself, but dashing, with an impressive head of hair. Decades later, as a federal prisoner, Navarro was disappointed to realize that he had to comb his hair without a mirror. Before returning to the U.S., Navarro encountered members of the Chinese diaspora in Burma, now Myanmar, and elsewhere. "Many who I met were refugees from the Mao years and Chinese Hunger Games that killed millions," he told me. After Navarro began writing about China in 2006, some UC Irvine colleagues, including Ben Leffel, his TA, doubted that he'd ever been to that country. His books and interviews included no personal recollections. When I asked Navarro about his history of travel to China, he at first deflected, saying that his more relevant experience had been in Burma and British Hong Kong. But Navarro later mentioned a reconnaissance trip to China, taken in 2006, that involved leveraging my Peace Corps experience at traveling like a native. The same visit could also fairly be described as a vacation taken with his wife. After joining the Trump administration, he visited China again as part of a government delegation. According to the Times, he and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin got into a profanity-laced shouting match in front of their Chinese counterparts. After the Peace Corps, Navarro returned to Boston. He brought Leibowitz some Thai artworks that still hang on his dining room wall. Navarro worked for a while at an energy consulting firm in D.C., then began a master's in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. Leibowitz recalled that Navarro bought and renovated a three-story building in one of Cambridge's more downscale neighborhoods. He was very smart that way, Leibowitz said. Navarro told me that his work on this beautiful rundown Victorian was his first practical lesson in economics. Navarro later bought a house in Falmouth on Cape Cod, where he became a devoted windsurfer. Navarro, whose master's focused on energy policy, has said that this work got him increasingly intrigued with economics and economic analysis. Much of Navarro's early public writing argues against rigid price controls in the energy market. He made the case for deregulation, later radical deregulation. Soon after Navarro began his PhD studies at Harvard in 1979, he sought out Jeff Dubin, an economics PhD student at MIT. In an academic discipline that often requires a combination of mathematics and storytelling, Navarro's clear talent was for the latter. He was a fast, fluent writer, but the former English major was now in a very rigorous, highly mathematical program, Dubin recently said. He didn't have the facility for that. Dubin did. As Dubin now puts it, Navarro's intelligence and entrepreneurial instinct allowed him to see a way to compensate for his deficits. The solution was, ironically, gains from trade. That phrase is at the heart of the free trade lexicon. Free trade in goods or services, unencumbered by tariffs or other barriers, is likely to lead to greater total output than if there had been no trade. Specialization makes economic sense. Not every country should grow its own peppers. Years ago, Navarro described this as one of the deepest truths in all of economics. He now refers to so-called gains from trade. In Cambridge, Navarro needed to produce a dissertation about the economics of corporate charitable giving. Dubin needed to pay his rent. I was a poor student, and he was rehabbing a triplex in Central Square. Money changed hands. He told me that the direction he wanted to go, and I helped him get there, theoretically and empirically, Dubin said. I might have used his data to set up models and get him going. And then he took over at some point, and it became his own. Dubin, speaking half-seriously, described this as one of my first consulting experiences. He observed that most people at that level would not pay someone else to help them. But Navarro saw nothing improper in the exchange, and neither did Dubin. The two men became close friends. We went to the Cape together, Dubin said. We double-dated. They also co-wrote several papers. Dubin remembers that Navarro, who was very into his health, into his body, was an enthusiast of dimethyl sulfoxide, DMSO, a gooey, unregulated byproduct of the paper industry that purportedly soothes muscle strains. According to Dubin, Navarro wasn't immune to the substance's notorious side effect. He reeked of garlic because of it. Navarro told me that today he doesn't drink, smoke pot, use any hard drugs, or even prescription medicines, adding, "Just not my thing. Live clean or die." Navarro's dissertation, submitted in 1986, doesn't acknowledge Dubin's contributions. According to every economist I asked, that omission constitutes an academic violation. Harry Holzer, a public policy professor at Georgetown, told me that if someone is actually developing his models for him, I think it crosses a boundary. Holzer, who served as the chief economist at the Department of Labor during the Clinton administration, is a former Harvard acquaintance of Navarro's. At a minimum, a footnote acknowledging a person's input is appropriate, Holzer said. Lawrence Golder, the sole surviving member of Navarro's dissertation committee, agrees. If Navarro received substantial help, he told me, then some recognition of that would have been expected, and its absence was inappropriate. Golder, who's now at Stanford, noted that at Harvard, Navarro had taught him to windsurf. Navarro asked if he'd engaged in academic deceit, said of Dubin, "You're listening to the New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan." I don't recall him providing any substantive assistance on my dissertation. Navarro also pointed to other publications in which he had thanked Dubin for his help. Later in life, Peter Navarro introduced readers of his books to a friend named Ron Vara. According to If It's Raining in Brazil by Starbucks, a 2001 book of financial advice that urged retail investors to be alert for world events, Vara had been the captain of a reserve unit at the time of the Gulf War. He now lived on a houseboat in Miami and was known as the Dark Prince of Disaster for making macro plays, trades taking nimble advantage of sudden onsets of human misery. Vara had macro played Hurricane Andrew and a Taiwanese earthquake. In 1986, when Vara was a struggling doctoral student in economics at Harvard, he'd apparently been clairvoyant. 2 days before the Chernobyl disaster, he'd shorted companies invested in nuclear energy. Vara appears in several other Navarro books, including Death by China, where he's quoted as saying, "Only the Chinese can turn a leather sofa into an acid bath, a baby crib into a lethal weapon, and a cell phone battery into heart-piercing shrapnel." Vara was also credited as the executive producer and the musical director of the video that Navarro showed to his Rising China class at UC Irvine. Ron Vara is an anagram of Navarro. Vara's fictional status was first reported in the Chronicle of Higher Education in 2019. Navarro had previously hidden the fact of Vara's non-existence even from Glenn Hubbard, who in 2010 co-authored a book with Navarro in which Vara was quoted. When the Chronicle asked Hubbard, a former dean of Columbia Business School, if he realized that Vara was an invention, and if he was comfortable with that, he replied, "No and no." An economist friend who used to play golf with Navarro told me that after reading the Raining manuscript, he saw what was going on and urged Navarro to reconsider, saying, "It's not appropriate." Navarro ignored him. Today, a note at the start of Raining says that Vara is an alias created by Peter Navarro. Everyone has regrets. Not everyone smuggles them into print in the form of an imaginary friend. The Ron Vara of Raining surely reveals some of Navarro's thoughts about how his own life could have turned out. The Dark Prince of Disaster is a fearless, military-trained man with a godlike ability to see everything coming. He knows it all. Raining, a book about geopolitical acuity, was published 8 months before the 9/11 attacks. It doesn't mention terrorism. But in an interview given in October 2001, Navarro attempted to fill, with what sounds like shamelessness, the gap between himself and his alter ego. He said, "The recent terrorist attack, I mean, it was a cinch to macro play." In the years after Navarro got his PhD, a distance started to open between the life he was surely due as a vigorous Harvard man with catalog model good looks and the one he found himself living. "I always had the idea that Peter wanted to be the next Jack Kennedy," the former golfing friend told me, adding, "If you get right on the threshold of your dream and you don't get to step through the door, I can imagine that could be pretty difficult." In the mid-80s, while Navarro was finishing his doctorate, he moved to San Diego. He met Janet Chenier, who was then working in a bookstore, and they got married. Former friends of the couple described Chenier as likable and quiet, certainly when juxtaposed with her husband, a dinner guest who didn't quite get the point of other people talking. The year of his wedding, Navarro turned 37. Jeff Dubin was then a professor at Caltech in Pasadena and still in his 20s. He'd get tenure at 30. Navarro fiercely desired a professorship at UC San Diego, where he'd briefly worked as a lecturer. But, Dubin told me, he wasn't strong enough academically. Navarro instead took a job at the University of San Diego, a small liberal arts college with a lower academic standing. He tried to remain in the orbit of the place, and he really wanted to get to, Dubin said. Dubin remembers visits to San Diego filled with windsurfing and bike rides. He was quite rigid in a lot of ways, Dubin said, or one could say disciplined. At the same time each morning, Navarro disappeared for an hour to write on his computer in what Dubin called his capsule. I would say, "What are you going to write about?" "Well, I don't know. I just write." Navarro published a few research papers, but most of his writing from this period wasn't academic. His first book, The Policy Game, published in 1984, before he finished his PhD, was the kind of text that might help an aspiring center-right politician build a reputation for seriousness. It argued that special interests of the left and the right, but mainly the left, often pulled decision-makers away from ideal public interest outcomes. Navarro devoted a chapter to the seductive foolishness of protectionist trade policies. Tariffs, he declared, make everyone a loser. In 1988, Navarro was hired by UC Irvine, whose campus is 80 miles north of downtown San Diego. This was despite his publication record, not because of it. The former golfing friend explained to me that at the time the university's business school was young and ambitious, and when you're an emergent program, being able to put a Harvard PhD on your faculty is definitely a consideration. The Navarros bought a house in Del Mar Heights, which is as close as you can be to Irvine without leaving either the ocean or the city of San Diego. The city boundary ran through their yard. Dubin recalled that UC Irvine solicited his opinion about Navarro's tenure candidacy. "I struggled," he told me. "We were friends, and yet he was not a strong academic." Dubin's evaluation focused on the impressive reach of Navarro's non-academic writing. "I was threading a needle," he said. He laughed. "To some degree, he's my fault." When Navarro ran for mayor of San Diego in 1992, he already had some local fame. For several years, he'd been arguing that the city had reached its residential capacity. "Growth is a game that has losers and winners," he'd said. "The people who win are the developers and the immigrants. The people who lose are the ones who already live here." He described one local housing proposal as Appalachia. Navarro had first offered such commentary as a spokesperson for a group that had pressed the city to impose a tight quota on the construction of new housing. San Diego's population was then growing nearly three times as fast as Los Angeles's. Navarro subsequently founded his own group, largely financed by his mother, which he called Prevents Los Angelization Now or Plan. The champion of deregulation here embraced radical regulation in a way that served his interests as a homeowner, but was also politically astute. Navarro was a self-declared conservative Republican in a Republican town, but his confrontational stance toward the real estate industry garnered him allies to his left. And local reporters working on almost any topic, sewage, traffic, immigration, would be glad for a comment from someone who could be described as a slow-growth guru. Peter Anderson, a local academic and green activist, supported Navarro's agenda and still remembers him as an environmentalist, comrade in arms, even if Navarro's desire to become a mover and shaker was intense. But Scott Flexo, another of Navarro's friends, who was then a political science graduate student, told me that he had long ago decided that Plan had merely been an organization that allowed Peter to run for office, Flexo added. "He didn't like teaching at UCI. He felt that he was better than the faculty, I think." In 1991, Navarro changed his voter registration to independent. When he joined the nonpartisan primary for the 1992 mayoral election, Susan Golding, the frontrunner, was a Republican with some real estate backing. Navarro could position himself to her left. Just 2 years later, he announced that he was a Democrat, a member of the party of the people and not the power brokers. He wasn't an energetic candidate, adept at scathing soundbites, but the San Diego Union Tribune raised an eyebrow at his chameleon-like tendencies and noted that when he meets with African Americans, he speaks with what can only be termed black street dialect. the top two candidates in that primary would remain on the ballot for the general election. Navarro came in first, Golding second. This was a remarkable upset, though Anderson and Flexo, who both worked on the campaign, found it hard to celebrate. On the night of this victory, Navarro didn't even thank his volunteers. Anderson recalled Flexo muttering, "What an asshole." Anderson then told me of another occasion when a hard-working volunteer, a doctor, ran into Navarro at a restaurant. According to Anderson, this doctor said, "Peter, can I join you?" And Peter said, "Not really. I'm just trying to focus." Someone who knows Navarro well recently described him to me as an introvert. If that's accurate, the trait clearly coexists with exhibitionism and pugnaciousness. During the mayoral race, Navarro got into a small physical fight with Golding's press secretary, Nikki Symington. He also called her a pig, and another with a 65-year-old man at La Jolla Cove. "If he wasn't so old, I would have kicked his ass," Navarro reportedly said at the time. After his primary success, Navarro was newly exposed to scrutiny. He was challenged on his funding and on his principles. According to Flexo, such pushback made him lose his mind. Anderson told me I would use a technique with him called systemic desensitization, a relaxation therapy. I'd get him kind of cooled down. Navarro arrived shivering at one radio debate in La Jolla wearing nothing but a Speedo after swimming a mile to get there. Golding's ex-husband was imprisoned for money laundering, a fact that Navarro highlighted in attack ads released shortly before the election. At a televised debate, Golding objected tearfully to having had her family dragged into the race. Navarro scoffed that her crying was rehearsed. He was probably right. Tom Shepard, then a Golding consultant, told me dryly that the issue came up in debate preparation. But he went on, a male candidate discounting the heartfelt protestations of a woman live on camera was really powerful. It was immediately clear to Navarro and to others that he'd made a mistake. Navarro lost by 4 points. In 1993, he ran for office again, this time for city council, and was defeated again. The following year, he failed in a bid for county supervisor. In 1996, he ran for Southern California congressional seat as a Democrat. This race drew national attention. He had a photo op with Vice President Al Gore, shared a stage with Hillary Clinton, and spoke briefly at the Democratic National Convention. But Navarro once more fell short, this time by more than 10 points. Lisa Ross, a family friend of the Navarros, worked as his communications director during his congressional run. She had previously volunteered on a public access show, News Behind the News, that Navarro hosted. Although she'd seen him gradually become more and more brittle in the face of electoral disappointments, she was still shocked by his peevishness during the campaign. On a visit to the editorial board of a local paper, for example, Navarro began by slamming a tape recorder onto the table. Ross, recalling the moment, "Oh God, just shoot me." She and Navarro never recovered their friendship. According to Mike Aguirre, the former San Diego city attorney, the congressional defeat threw Navarro into a Grand Canyon of failure. His marriage also ended, although he soon began a relationship with Leslie Laban, an architect and one of his recent MBA students. They later married. In 1998, Navarro published a score-settling political memoir, San Diego Confidential, in which he recalled having learned via focus groups and polling that many voters saw him as overbearing and obnoxious and an opportunist. "This data revealed to me a frightening part of my personality," he wrote, adding that most people would rather vote for a nice person they sometimes disagree with than for an asshole who perfectly represents their views. That insight didn't lead him to modulate his tone. The memoir describes a San Diego City Council member as a bespeckled lesbian with a thick, amorphous body of a bull dyke gone to seed. In 2001, Navarro ran in his fifth and final race for city council and received less than 8% of the vote. That year, he launched a new career as a get-rich investment advisor, citing Ron Vera as his model of success. This work came to include several books, numerous CNBC appearances, and a blog about investing. In August 2008, a month before Lehman Brothers collapse, Navarro advises readers to buy U.S. stocks, arguing, "This is not a good time to be short." In 2010, Michael Addis thought of himself as a comedy director. His best-known work was a documentary about hecklers at stand-up shows. When Navarro asked him to direct a film derived from Death by China, which he'd written with Greg Autry, a PhD candidate at UC Irvine, Addis's reaction was, "That sounds like a terrible title." But Addis had just divorced and he needed the money. "I was desperate," he recalled. He and Navarro agreed on a weekly rate. Addis isn't particularly proud of the resulting film, but he likes some parts, and despite having leftish leanings, he has vestigial respect for Navarro. "He was a guy who just would get up early, study like crazy," Addis said. "He wasn't a bad guy. He cared about this concept that America could be stronger if we didn't outsource so many jobs. I think his heart was in the right place." Addis and Navarro filmed interviews with figures sympathetic to Navarro's cause, including the Democratic Congressman Tim Ryan of Ohio and Tom Danjuk of the Steel Manufacturers Association. This was a bare-bones operation. Addis sometimes operated a camera and also asked a question or two. Navarro explained to Addis that he planned to link these interviews with animated sequences providing editorial commentary. The Death by China book, and before that, The Coming China Wars from 2006, cataloged acts of Chinese government delinquency derived from both reliable secondary sources, the Financial Times, and questionable ones, Ron Vara. Navarro presented these sins, including currency manipulation, intellectual property theft, and environmental degradation, as significant drivers of China's extraordinary economic transformation. If one set aside the most powerful mechanisms behind China's growth, such as low labor costs and industrial planning, although it wasn't clear why one would set those aside, then it was easy to see that the country had scammed its way to success. Western sunniness about coexistence with China, of the Tom Friedman kind, should be scorned. America hadn't been outpaced by a flawed rival. It had been mugged. Navarro dedicated the coming China wars to our children, for whom the catastrophe of a dominant China was a greater threat than nuclear or biological war. Addis recalled making a teasing suggestion. "I was like, we need to have a knife, and it says, 'Made in China,' and it stabs the U.S. and blood pours out." According to Addis, Navarro replied, "That's a great idea." Addis told him, "I'm kidding." Navarro ran with it anyway. The resulting sequence resembles a Halloween week sofa promotion advertised on local TV. Addis sometimes worked with Navarro at a house that Navarro and Laban had recently bought and renovated in Laguna Beach, south of UC Irvine. "The view from the deck was insane," Addis said. Navarro was extraordinarily focused. From the moment he opened the door for Addis, they were at work. Navarro might continue a discussion while taking a cold water plunge in a specialized indoor tub. Navarro described these dips to me as good for the body and soul. In a collaboration that lasted 2 years, on and off, Addis could remember only one purely social interaction when Navarro asked if he wanted to take a break and watch The Big Bang Theory. Addis declined. According to Addis, Navarro was certain that HBO would acquire their film. Addis told him he was wrong. They were assembling 75 minutes of talking head interviews, followed by on-screen text instructing viewers to call their representatives to demand a strong manufacturing base. The film had no real narrative wit, unless you count the dagger puncturing the Midwest or the Bruce Springsteen pastiche written by Navarro that plays over the end credits. "I used to work in a factory. Right now I'd work for anything. They sent our jobs away, and in China they're not workers, they're just slaves." Navarro ended up taking the director's credit for himself. Addis was a little relieved to give it up. He became a producer. Navarro had by then accepted that the film was not going to be a mainstream hit, and he seemed deflated. After a preview screening, Addis recalled, Navarro conceded that the stabbing sequence was maybe a bit much. Navarro doesn't remember saying that. He now regards this animation as the signature image of the film. wouldn't change it for the world, he told me. Like the acknowledgments in Navarro's PhD dissertation, the end credits of Death by China omit an important detail. They don't acknowledge that Nucor, a Charlotte-based steel company facing competition from rising Chinese steel production, gave Navarro $1 million to make it. Navarro has sometimes been asked why he became fixated on lambasting China in the mid-2000s. He has consistently responded that, in the early years of the century, he noticed that his MBA students and ex-students were struggling to find good jobs. In his effort to understand this, Navarro concluded that all roads led to China's lawless rise. This makes little sense. In 2005, the U.S. unemployment rate for college graduates was 2.5%, the same as it had been 10 years earlier. In the same period, real GDP, adjusted for inflation, increased by 40%. For decades, the American economy had been losing manufacturing jobs, more to automation than to overseas competition, but gaining other jobs. This was no comfort to a discarded factory worker, but it didn't leave a would-be entrepreneur or executive particularly exposed. But decrying China's misdeeds surely looked like an opportunity, a self-positioning macro play. As Navarro's former friend Scott Flexo put it, he's always looking for something to blame. This cause, nominally bipartisan, could help him build powerful alliances. And as with the topic of San Diego real estate, any counterargument had to meet him partway. Property developers can indeed be snakes. The Chinese economy is not a model for free trade. Without great risk to social status, Navarro could deploy the hyperbolic and xenophobic rhetoric that he clearly enjoyed. He could ask, why are so many Chinese blackhearts so willing to poison the world's food and drug supply for profit? Navarro's romance with Nucor was first evident in 2009. In his book, Always a Winner, Finding Your Competitive Advantage in an Up-and-Down Economy, he gushed that Nucor was the safest, highest quality, lowest cost, most productive, and most profitable steel company in the world. He praised Nucor's uncanny ability to profitably navigate through the up-and-down movements of the business cycle. In fact, Nucor had lost half of its value in the 15 months before the book's publication. Navarro's mother gave the book 4 stars, but not 5, on Amazon. Navarro and Dan DiMicco, then Nucor's chairman and CEO, subsequently co-wrote an essay for Barron's, which argued that the U.S. should get tough with China. In 2011, in the book version of Death by China, Navarro included a section titled Be Like Nucor Steel, Dan DiMicco, not GE's Jeffrey Immelt. The Nucor Alliance anticipated the ideologically flexible spirit in which Navarro entered the White House. Even the most slapdash blackhearts-infused critique of Chinese government practices will tend to draw an author into passing appreciation of political transparency, pollution controls, a free press, the rule of law, worker protections, religious tolerance, the freedom to protest, and other values that used to carry weight in both of America's main political parties. Crouching Tiger contrasts American democracy to Chinese corruption and plundering. The book version of Death by China, quotes Camus, is the job of thinking people not to be on the side of executioners. But anyone being paid by Nucor in 2010 was being pulled harder in another direction. Nucor was anti-union. It had paid huge fines for disregarding environmental regulations. It had a record of mistreating minority workers. DiMicco stepped down in 2012. After a spell as a Trump campaign advisor in 2019, he became visible as a QAnon curious Twitter presence with opinions about George Soros. DiMicco and Navarro never announced that their mutual regard had a cash component. That fact became known only because of the peculiar efforts made to hide it. In March 2011, Nucor sent $1 million in 2 checks to Michael Shames, an old friend of Navarro's who ran a nonprofit, the Utility Consumers Action Network, UCAN, whose stated mission was to protect the interests of California energy customers. A few days later, Shames signed a contract in which Navarro, acting as a consultant for UConn, agreed to make the Death by China documentary for $1 million. In return, UConn would receive 5 DVDs of the film. That spring, David Peffer, a lawyer at UConn, began a whistleblowing campaign that alerted the organization's board to various odd accounting actions taken by Shames, including this deal. A steel company had paid for a film that clearly served its interests through a consumer nonprofit that had nothing to do with China or steel. When the San Diego Reader first reported on this funding triangle, a Nucor representative told the paper that routing the cash through UConn had been Navarro's idea. And that's all we have time for today. By Ian Parker. Ian Parker has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 2000. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker Magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker Magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.